You're listening to KRUULP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa. It's a bright and sunny, solar-powered Monday morning. We're live on the air April 11th, and this is Writers' Voices. I'm your host, Monica Hadley, and with me today is my co-host, Cheryl Fusco-Johnson. Good morning, Cheryl.
Good morning, Monica. I'm thrilled to be here with you today.
I'm thrilled to be here, too, because we have a really amazing guest this morning.
Absolutely.
And I have to tell the story that I about how this happened.
Well, it was quite a coup that you got this guest.
I felt like that. Anne Lamott has been one of my favorite writers ever since she published Bird by Bird, which is
a classic among all people who are interested in writing.
It is, absolutely. And I was rereading through it this morning, and you know what? I bet that's her right now. So let me, why don't you talk a little bit about Anne, and I'll get her on the air.
I would love to do that. Anne Lamott is a very accomplished writer in many genres. She is the author of the New York Times bestseller, Grace, Eventually. Other books by her are Plan B, Traveling Mercies, and Operating Instructions. Operating Instructions was about her journey as a single mother of a son named Sam. But she's also written nonfiction books. Well, that was a nonfiction book, but books about the craft of writing. And the classic is Bird by Bird. And that's a book that many writing teachers offer to their students because it's a wonderful book for helping people overcome writer's block. So, but the book we're going to be talking about today is called Imperfect Birds. And it's the third in a series of three books about a family.
And we now have Anne on the air with us. Welcome to Writer's Voices, Anne.
Thank you. I'm so sorry. I guess I'm jet laggy or something, but I've been sitting here like a little dog waiting for you to call. Then I realized I was supposed to call you.
Well, we're here together now, and we're really excited. You may have heard this story already because I told your publicist a little bit, but about a month ago, I was walking out my back door, and I had your book, Plan B, Further Thoughts on Faith, sitting by the back door. And I just glanced at it, and I thought, wow, I would sure love to have Anne Lamott on Writer's Voices, but that'll probably never happen. And that day, Imperfect Birds appeared in my mail from your publisher. And the next day, I got the email asking if we'd like to do an interview. So it was just like total serendipity.
Oh, great. Good. Well, here we are.
Here we are. So with us also is Cheryl Fusco-Johnson, who is a children's writer and she's my co-host today. And she is also a fan, I would say.
Big fan.
Big fan.
So, thank you.
So, Anne, where are you calling from today?
I'm calling from my best friend's house in Chicago. I'm here for 2 days to do a Chicago event in Milwaukee, and yesterday was my birthday, and
oh,
we had a
perfect
birthday. And now I'm on the couch in my Ethel Mertz jammies.
Fantastic.
So what did a perfect birthday look like for you?
A perfect birthday was just to be with him, for one thing, and then I got a perfect scarf, like you get so many terrible scarves, but I got a scarf I would have picked out that goes with everything, and then we went for a really long walk along the Chicago waterfront. It was blowing, but wild, rich blue waves, and just extraordinary, but almost hard to walk in. And then we went and saw a movie, Win Win, which I thought was adorable and fun and fine, and I had great popcorn, which is major and central to all of existence. And then we went to this unbelievable restaurant where Rahm Emanuel hangs out called Yoshi's, and we had a seriously amazing, very simple and unfussy but exquisite meal. Then we came home, and I made Doug watch Celebrity Apprentice. I went to bed. It was like the perfect birthday.
Well, happy birthday. And after Chicago, you're coming to Iowa.
I am. I heard there was a terrible tornado there today, though.
Well, not where we are.
I heard about that on the news driving in, but I just got the tail end of it, so I'm not sure where it hit, but it sounded like it was pretty serious.
Wow. Well, it's beautiful and sunny here in Fairfield.
Okay.
So, but you'll be
Fairfield
in...
Fairfield near Des Moines?
Fairfield's about 2 hours from Des Moines.
Okay.
And you'll be in Des Moines Wednesday, April 13th at 7 p.m. at the Hoyt Sherman Place Theater.
Okay, and well, does this radio show reach as far as Des Moines?
It doesn't reach as far as Des Moines on the air, but it does on the internet. We have a lot of listeners all over on the internet.
Oh, okay, cool.
Yeah. Yes.
And you're going to have a very enthusiastic audience, I think, in Des Moines. I know that there's an entire writers group that's going together to go hear you.
Okay, cool. Good.
Yeah. So, and how did you, when did you know that you wanted to be a writer?
I think it was always really kind of in the stars. My father, Kenneth Lamont, was a writer, and the first thing was that I saw someone deeply in the habit of getting his work done every day, and he would get up at 5:30, be at the desk by 5:30, really come hell or high water, 5 days a week, and then he'd get up, then at 7 he'd get us all up and make breakfast, and we were always a reading family. We all went to the public library, the church at the public library Thursday night, and all, I have two brothers, and we all packed up enough books to last the week, and then it just turned out I had a gift, and I was writing pretty early and getting feedback, and my dad would give me little assignments, I remember, and I just was good at it, you know, and I was also a really good storyteller, and the kids would always sort of look to me to tell them a story of what we had all just collectively seen. So over time, I just became really, you know, more and more attentive to detail and to trying to really see what was there. And let's see, I dropped out of college at 19 because I wanted to be a writer. I went to Goucher College in Maryland for a couple of years, and I had a column in the paper, and that was really heady, you know. And then I dropped out and moved back to San Francisco, and I started writing. I got a job with a magazine, that Billie Jean King's women's sports magazine, that came right after Title IX had been passed, so that where there was equalization in high school and college sports between the sexes. And then I was off and running. I worked there about a year, and then I, by 21, was very, very much into the practice of writing.
Now, you've also been a writing teacher, I believe.
I have been, but not for years and years. There's a great independent bookstore in Marin called Book Passage, sort of the most important bookstore, and they have a huge room for readings, and I had a class of students there that would be 10 weeks at a time, and it was very free for all, and I mean, it wasn't free. I had to pay except for my friends and the riffraff who got in free, but it was great, and I did that for years. I think I quit when Sam was about 9, though, when he's 21, because I just felt a little bit of burnout. But, yeah, I taught writing, but now I mostly just have a really dull, quiet life of a writer. If I have a book out, I have to travel to promote it. But other than that, I really am a homebody. I do what I've been doing since I was 20, which is I sit down at the same time every day. You know, I do it badly, and then I do it again.
That's one of the main themes of Bird by Bird, isn't it? That you do it badly. The what you call the
shitty you do
first
it badly,
draft.
And that everything everybody loves by any writer out there began as a really bad first draft. It's the way it comes. There's no fantasy out there of where people just match. You know, I have 12 books out now, and Perfect Birds is the 12th book. And I don't sit down in the morning and go, oh, my God, it's just so great to be me, and I feel so positive about my voice and my, you know. I'm in
questions.
The same boat everybody else is in. I have terrible self-esteem and a lot of grandiosity, but I have the habits of writing. I sit down, I carve out a small thing I'm going to handle, the sort of bird-by-bird concept, and then I do it badly, and I know by now that a terrible, unreadable, overly long first draft is the way home.
Wow. I'm curious about Sam. So in one of your essays that I read recently, you talked about at that point, which was quite a few years ago, he was mostly interested in reading about, it sounded like, electronics and not the sorts of things you were interested in reading, and it wasn't like...
It's a little bit hard to hear you. I can hear what you just said, but if there's any way to be a little bit louder, it would help me.
So I was curious if Sam developed the reading habit. Does he like to read fiction now and nonfiction?
Sam is he's very much into reading stuff for his own studies. He's in an academy of art where he's studying graphic design. He reads a lot of spiritual stuff, but he mostly reads design stuff. He doesn't read novels for pleasure. It's funny. It's like when I was raising Sam, all of us that were feminists were, all the feminists that had daughters saw them, you know, just want to wear tutus and, you know, and lip gloss at 4 years old. And me, the most voracious reader I know, had a son who loved to be read to in bed at night, but wasn't his own reader. He was a drawer. He was, from the very beginning, an inventor.
Mm-hmm. Well, they come into the world with their own...
Yep, they really do.
And, of course, you've been writing about him since he was born. And
huh?
You've been writing about him since he was a baby. And I'm curious how that is, like, when you're so public. Like, you're living your life in a really public way. And in a way, so are your friends and family. And I'm wondering how
that... But I would take issue with that to some degree, because people think that I'm writing such intimate stuff, but then when I ask people to give me an example of something intimate they know about me or Sam, it's really not intimate at all. I don't talk about our private life. I don't ever talk about anyone in my family. One exception when I wrote about my mom in Traveling Mercies that I think hurt her. I don't write about the truth of Sam's life. I don't write about the stuff about my life that I would only share with a handful of friends. I write about stuff, by the time I write about it, it may seem confessional, but by the time I write about it, I've told it so many times from the stage, and I absolutely know it's universal.
Well, that's the thing, so, what you're writing feels so authentic, so I guess that was how I was
thinking. I hope it's authentic, but I also don't think that it's really particularly intimate. I mean, I think my voice is an intimate voice, but I don't think anyone knows any very interesting details. I mean, I know you don't, because I know what my life is like. I know what my family's been through the last 4 years, my brothers and I and Sam, and it's not out there. You know, I mean, I'm very, very selective about what I do share, but because I have a voice that's intimate, because I love to be real and, as you say, authentic, it's more human and real and one-on-one than most writers are. But, you know, if I challenge you all of a sudden to tell you something about myself that is intimate, I don't really think you could do it, because I don't think it's a sleight of hand. I'm not trying to make it seem that way. It's just that I know by the time I write something, I'm positive it's not just me.
Well, I don't think that the fact that it's not just you makes it not intimate. You know, it's
well,
like,
give me an example.
Well, like I was just, when I was looking through Bird by Bird this morning and you were talking about school lunches, it made me feel like I knew you as a child.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, and what you were like and your, and yes, absolutely, it's universal, but it's also really you.
Mm-hmm.
I'm assuming
that's
it's
sort of
really
like
you.
How we express the universal is by exposing ourselves a little bit. So I didn't mean to imply that
maybe that vocabulary is just wrong. I hope it's universal and it's my details. I mean, that's really what writers have to offer. All I can tell you is my version of things. All I can tell you is what I make of it. But I tell about 2% of the experience. You know, there it's like a bullseye, and in the center of that is my relationship with me and God as I understand God and my history, and then one circle outside of the bullseye is stuff I would talk about with literally two or three people, and the next ring is stuff that I would talk about with 5 or 10 people, then the next ring is stuff I would talk about from the stage, very much censoring myself, and the next ring out is stuff I might write about. But the school lunch stuff I love, but I think our vocabularies were just misunderstood, because
yeah,
I do think that's intimate.
Yeah,
I mean, I actually find it excruciatingly intimate, but it's not confessional. You know, it's not anything that is secretive about my life.
Right, right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't write anything that's going to hurt anybody.
No, I don't. I don't think you would. Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't see that. And but still, children sometimes. I mean, my kids sometimes would get annoyed that I would tell people things about them that I didn't even think were that intimate. You know, that I wouldn't consider intimate at all. And you know, I don't know if you had that issue with Sam at all.
Well, after the age of about 10, I started clearing every single story with him. You know, I talked about it before I wrote it. I showed it to him when I finished. And every single thing, and including that story I wrote, which is the one behind-the-scenes story of our life that some people found sort of shocking, which was the one about when I slapped him finally at the age of 16 when I had just lost it one day. I told him I wanted to write about it, and he said, well, we'll see.
So that was the
I wrote him a, I wrote a draft of being pushed so far by this cold, angry, lying teenager, although I didn't, you know, I didn't give the back story about what was what our life was like. And I showed it to him. He said, you can't run this. You make me look like the crazy one. I wrote it again so that it just was more truthful, and it just showed if you got a problem, you got to go look in the mirror. You know, usually it's not one person's not the problem. And so I rewrote it, and he liked it. And then when I ran it at Salon, the editor, without this is years ago, too, this is five or six years ago, the editor ran it without, the edit ran about 10 letters that were devastating attacks on me, one of them, in fact, including a reference to the pedophile priests, and said I had crossed such a line that I could now be considered one of them. And Sam, upon hearing this, wrote a letter to the editor at Salon and said, my mother quits. You're there to protect your writers, and you haven't done that. Then a couple of days later, I said, take me back, because I really love Salon. Anyway, then a couple of years later, he was in a junior college briefly in the Pacific Northwest, and I was giving a reading at a big auditorium. It was like a college event. And so I said, bring your friends. He brought 20 of his friends, and they got the first row and stretched all the way around the side of the auditorium, and then Sam and I were backstage. I said, what do you want me to read? He said, oh, my God, it's called Heat. He said, read the Heat piece. I think it's the best thing you ever wrote, and I think it'll help the most people.
Oh.
So, you know, we are very much about talking about this stuff. The worst thing on earth would be to betray his confidence and trust, and I haven't. And he loves it so much. He loves so much that his entire childhood, including up till now, although I haven't written a nonfiction in a few years, so, but that it includes these stories that were like really precious videos or really precious photographs of our most challenging and most wonderful and hilarious times together. So he, you know, he's like my biggest fan, but I can understand, you know, there's other stories. We were lucky that we have good rapport and that he's a good kid, but I know other stories where parents write about their kid's addiction or, you know, history, their really darker history, and I think then it's kind of dicey to be on the receiving end of that, and I know there have been a lot of, there have been lawsuits and great public rage and family rage that intimacy was breached. So, you know, it's a legitimate concern for writers.
Well, that's really interesting.
I've always tried to walk the line, tried to write stuff that I thought he would be very happy I've written.
We did an interview with Hope Edelman a year or so ago, and she, I don't know if you know her, but she writes about her life very intimately also, and she wrote... she wrote Motherless Daughters and Motherless Mothers. And she said in one of her books where she was writing about her father raising her after her mother passed away, and, you know, there were some issues there, and she gave the draft to her father to read, but only after It was like almost ready to publish, so he could only change, she would only change something if it was really important to him to change. And the only thing that he picked out was something, some really minor detail about, I think it was about a fur coat that her mother owned or something. And he said that wasn't the actual fact of that coat. You know, it was different.
Oh, funny.
I know. And then after it was published, but he did feel a little uncomfortable about it, but after it was published, he thought he was going to be shown as sort of the bad guy, but instead he got all this support from people about what an amazing job he had done in a bad situation. So, yeah, it was really interesting.
Yeah, definitely.
I found something in one of your essays really interesting about appearances, and you wrote that someone didn't know she could take care of the inside of things, like people or your own heart, by tending to appearances or surfaces. You put on a little blusher or moisturizer, or you make the bed. And that's fascinating to me, because I feel like in my life I'm constantly battling clutter and being concerned about appearances. And I wondered if you could talk a little bit about how tending to outside things can help inside things.
Well, I think that that's pretty true a lot of the time. And I'm a person who doesn't thrive in clutter because I like things. I mean, I'm kind of an aging hippie tribal stomp, flopping around on the couch and playing with the dogs person. But for my own peace of mind and my own organization as a writer, I need things to really be together. I don't think that's a general truth. I think it's, some people are very comfortable. I don't mind a really messy desk. It's funny. And papers everywhere in my office. That feels to me like that the field is very fertile and that there's lots and lots of stuff you might draw upon or search through for insight or for whatever. But for me, there's no way I could write in the morning. I sit down at 9. There's no way I could write if my house is a mess. I don't write with, I think the connections and the what tethers us to the desk and yet at the same time allows our imaginations to take off has to do with how you create your, you know, the creation station, as they used to say, I think, on PBS, and what Sam grew up with. He always had a creation station. And so for me, the way of having a tether to the desk and a free rein to roam very much has to do with certain things being in place. I think things tend to be reflective. The outside tends to be reflective of what's going on the inside. And you know, when people are sick, for instance, and really sick, it's hard to know how to take care of their soul or if you're even in charge of taking their care of their soul. But a very old person or young person with cancer or some sort of grim grim prognosis or grim future, to stop and be with that person and to put a lot of moisturizer on their limbs and to help them get a haircut that makes them feel pretty is a direct way to take care of their soul. And or to do their toenails, you know, to arrange for a person who's old to have pretty toenails instead of what happens to old people, which is that the details aren't tended to, like that. And so for someone to look down and to see short pink toenails is one of the most profound gifts you can give to somebody who has very, very few opportunities for a sense of liberation or beauty.
Well, you're listening to Writer's Voices. Our guest today is Anne Lamott, and my co-host is Cheryl Fusco-Johnson. And let's move to talking about the purpose of your book tour that you're on, which is your new novel, Imperfect Birds. Was that just published?
Came out a year ago. It just came out in paperback.
Okay. This is the third book about the same family.
Right.
So why have you done it this way, where you've stuck with this one family to write about?
Well, I'd always wanted to go back after I wrote the first book in the trilogy, Rosie. I was still drinking at the time. I got sober in 1986, but Rosie was published in 83. And I felt, and I love these characters, this little girl with very, very blue eyes and thick black curls whose hair had, father just died, and her mother, the widow Elizabeth, who is really knocked off her feet, who I think is an amazing creation, but really barely able to take care of herself, let alone a child that she had to be talked into having. And so I wrote a second part that, let's see, 83 was when Rosie came out. Crooked Little Heart, I think, came out in the, I don't even know, actually, maybe late 90s, mid to late 90s. And but 3 years have passed, no more than that, I think about 8 years have passed. And and she's 13 and 14. And I'd always also really wanted to write about my tennis years, because I played competitive tennis in the Northern California circuit for 6 or 7 years, and it was just devastating to my self-esteem because I ended up just having none. And I had cheated for one summer in an effort to get a better ranking, and, you know, called balls out that were actually my my rivals' balls out that were in, I wanted to write about what would bring a really great person like Rosie or me to that point of lack of integrity and terror of not being good enough. And so I had loved Rosie and Elizabeth and Elizabeth's best friend Ray and her husband James, a little scrappy writer, so much. I thought, oh, I'd love to give them this story. It's a good story. It's an important story. The way that competition grinds children down, hurts their being and their psyche. And I loved it so much because the novel's hard. It's so much easier for me to write nonfiction. And and I was very happy. You know, you just become so much better as a writer when you stop drinking. The great Palace Lie has said if you're an alcoholic writer, you're going to lose your creativity and your, you know, the muse is somehow the disease of being a drunk. But so then 4 or 5 years ago, when my own son was going through his mid-teens, I started talking to a lot of the girls in our town about this hooking up business and what was in it for them and why they were agreeing to this bizarre pre-women's movement sexual behavior. And they just trusted me, and they started telling me stories and what was in it for them. And you know, if the guys really like you for the night, and like, yeah. I started wondering if it was even possible that Rosie would have gotten into that, because she has such a rich family. Her parents, her mother and stepfather, have such a good marriage. And Ray, her mom's best friend, is like her aunt or her godmother, and very spiritual and comical and really like the world's best aunt. And but, you know, she's in this town much like my own where kids are dying and kids are getting in car crashes, and kids have discovered OxyContin, which used to not be a high school recreational drug, and now is the reason most of the ODs in our area are Oxy. Mm-hmm. They're smoking this unbelievably strong marijuana on a daily basis, and people, the adults and some authorities go around and say you can't be addicted to marijuana, but it's such a crock. And if you can't go without it, you're addicted, you know. If you've lost the ability to decide whether or not you're going to smoke dope that day, and you decide you're going to because you have to, then you're addicted. It takes away kids' motivation. You see the really precious kids in our town go from very cool, hot 7th and 8th graders to being really unmotivated and only wanting to be with their friends. And then by the same token, you see these parents in psycho helicopter mode trying to make sure that their kids get into the great colleges. And it's just killing everybody. The thing that concerned me was that it was killing the children. They were having a suicide every year, and in fact, that's in the first paragraph of Imperfect Birds, is that every year someone from our county jumps off the Golden Gate Bridge. So I just started to be consumed with this how impossible it is to be a teenager these days. I was a drunken and stoned teenager, but I didn't have the complete telecommunications setup that these kids had, and I very consciously made a decision that this was going to be written according to the old chronology of the first book being in 83 and, you know, being back then, because if you write a book about the modern teenager, you're writing about cell phones, which I didn't want to do. So that's how it all sort of came into being. I have to really love people if I'm going to spend 3 years with them, and I felt very strongly about the people in this book, in the earlier two books.
Do you feel like you're done with Rosie, or do you think it's possible there might be...
I might be done with novels. I feel that I'm pretty exhausted by writing novels, and I am not sure what I am going to be doing, but I hope I don't write any more novels, so in that sense, I'm done with them. Yeah. It's very hard, and I've always asked people, if you had 1 year to live, are your choices going to be different than they are now? Yeah, I don't think you're going to make yourself so crazy every day. I don't think you're going to be willingly throwing your life away trying to keep your butt firm. That you're going to fixate so much on the minutiae and the multitasking and that. I think if you have a year to live, you're going to live in a very different and profound way. And so I try to go by that. And if I had a year to live, I wouldn't try to get another novel done.
What motivated you to write novels? You've been so successful with your essays, and you say novels are much more difficult for you. Why did you do it?
Well, my first four books were novels, and I think it's probably because I grew up just loving novels. Just that's what I want to read. And I always told my writing students to read what they wanted to come upon. And what I wanted to come upon was novels by very smart people, very smart women that were telling the truth and entertaining and throwing some light on. And so I've tried in my way to do that in the world. And then the fifth book was operating instructions about my son's first year, and that was actually sort of accidental. I'd always just planned on being a novelist. I thought that's what I was. And then I loved that. It didn't take that long to write. It took a year, just a journal. And then while I was writing it, I just realized that the main thing I had to offer as a writing teacher was, like, truth, which is that most writing teachers were trying to help students get published and trying to keep that, you know, the dangling the carrot in front of them that if they got published, they'd be all well and their problems would sort themselves out because they'd instantly have so much self-esteem because they had been published. And it's just such a lie. It's just the lie machine. And so I started putting together a talk that I thought might lead to a writing book, and it was all the most important things I knew about, which were the two main ideas being the terrible first draft, which is a whole chapter, and the second thing being bird by bird, that it's very short assignments, and that, you know, one passage that you know you're going to include that you think involves these details and not those, but you don't know until you write it, and, you know, and I started, and it seemed to be really helpful to people because everybody else had, or not everybody, of course, but people gave the impression that you're supposed to know what you're doing when you're writing and what it's going to look like when it's done, and that is absolutely the furthest thing from the truth I can say from my own experience. So I just set out to write a book that might be really deeply useful both logistically and at a soul level for other writers, and to say to them, you may very well not get published, and getting published may make you sicker than you could have ever dreamt of being, but here's what I do to get my work done every day if you're interested. So, and then after that I've written three more novels after that, so, you know, it's been, I would say, pretty hodgepodgey.
Some people have, I believe, that I've seemed to recall this, that your work has sometimes been compared to Flannery O'Connor, your novels.
I've never heard that.
Well, I'm pretty sure that I read this, like, in the last couple days, but I'm not positive. But I don't know why Flannery O'Connor would come to mind to me otherwise. But I do feel that you have a very spiritual bent in your novels, and they also are providing, just like Bird by Bird is tremendously comforting to many people, I think your novels are as well, because you do have this kind of very practical spirituality that you're expressing in it. So in some ways, I hope you're not done with novels, but I want you to be happy, so whatever you want to give us is fine. That's your reading public.
You know, having raised two children, two adults.
Honestly, right now, I couldn't tell you, but my hope is that I not write any more novels. If I had a year to live, I would not be working on fiction. Mm. And none of us knows.
Pardon?
I said, if I had a year to live, I wouldn't be working on fiction, and none of us really knows
what
the future holds. So I really, really use that as a kind of benevolent pressure when I'm making choices about... Uh-huh. How, you know, I was 57 yesterday, it's my birthday, and how am I going to spend my 58th year on Earth? And it's going to really be informed by a sense of urgency and, paradoxically, an urgency towards less stress and less to do, less that I agree to do for other people, and a more inward focus, which is my focus, and what does run through the novels is a inward and spiritual focus. And so, you know, the thing is, I don't really know what I'll be doing. We'll check in next year.
Do you think you will be writing this year, though?
Oh, absolutely. So, I mean, I'm a writer.
Do you have
that's all I'm good at. I'm unemployable.
Do you have a project you're thinking of?
I was raised by a writer, so I was raised believing that if you had a gift, it was like eventually when I started reading Harry Potter, Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, to my son, I realized, like, to be a writer means that you got one of the gold license, you know, one of the gold tickets.
Mm.
And if you blow it, if you want to write and you're not writing, it's going to break your heart someday. Mm. And so, no, I feel like it's a real honor to have been chosen to be one of the community storytellers. And to be able to make a campfire and say to people, you want to hear a story? Or want to come sit by the fire for an hour? Something's been noodling around in my mind that I think you might find interesting.
That really is the basis of it all, isn't it? The story.
Yeah.
So, Anne, would you like to read a passage from Imperfect Birds for us this morning?
You know, I know I was supposed to, but I think this is the second major mistake. Let me go see if Doug has a copy of the book.
Hey, you know,
I forgot to bring one.
It's okay if you don't. We're having a great time talking.
Okay.
So you're listening to Writers' Voices with Monica and Cheryl Fusco-Johnson, and our guest today is Anne Lamott, the author.
And I'm padding around in the Ethel Mertz Tammy Snell, looking at Doug's.
And Anne is...
Oh, yeah, here we have a hardback of it.
All right, all right.
There were two things about this interview. I was supposed to call, supposed to read a couple passages from the book. So far, I've managed to not do very well with either of those, but I did find Doug's copy.
Well, the important thing is that we're having this conversation, which is an extreme honor and pleasure for us. So
absolutely.
So do you want to hear a couple of short passages? I do have a book.
Yes, please.
Tell the publicist I produced the book.
Yes, please do.
Please make sure I get a full credit. Okay, so this is the first chapter. I won't read. I'll just read a few minutes. But the first chapter is called The Parkade, and I'll read you... I'll just read a few passages. Is that okay book?
Yes. Yes, perfect.
Okay. There are so many evils that pull on our children. Even in the mellow town of Lansdale, where it's easy to see only beauty and decency, a teenager died nearly every year after a party, and kids routinely went from high school to psych wards, halfway houses, or jail. Once a year, a child from the county of Marin jumped off the Golden Gate Bridge. Elizabeth Ferguson looked around at the Saturday morning comings and goings of townspeople and saw parents who had lost or were losing their kids, kids who had lost or were losing their minds. She and James sat with their coffees and newspaper on the wide steps of the parkade, which was what everyone in town called the parking bay in the center of town, making it seem a lot more festive than it really was. It was a big parking lot that abutted the boulevard that ran from San Quentin to the east, all the way out to Olema on the Pacific coast, but several feet higher than the town's original crossroads, so you had to climb up steps to reach it and drive downhill to exit. There was a bus kiosk on the north side and two weathered steps of concrete, the one where Elizabeth and her husband James sat reading, another at the far end across from the movie theater. She and James were waiting for her daughter, whom they were going to take shopping in town, if she ever arrived. Rosie needed notebooks and some summer tops for her last week as a junior at the local high school, and shops fanned out below the parkade, stretching almost to the northern face of Mount Tamalpais. But Rosie was nowhere in sight. Elizabeth felt large and worried. Even sitting down, she was taller than her husband, and her otherwise dark, thick hair was slightly more gray streaked. But Rosie was taller than either, almost 5'11", black-haired, strapping, and fabulous, except when they wanted to disown her, like now. Some of the young men converging at the kiosk had cultivated the look of homelessness, but without the inconvenience and hardship. Car keys dangled from their belts as they drank $4 lattes. Some looked like star athletes because they were, or had been, but you saw a feral, dark energy in some of the young here, of despair, blankness, failure, and indirect gazes, ill health, and sometimes a dangerous raw male potency. The grunge, the piercings, the clothes that deliberately didn't fit, that said, I am the best, I am the worst, the tattoos that were psychic band-aids to cover the wounds. Then we have kind of an introduction to the fact that everybody has gotten older, the four main adults, which is Elizabeth and her husband James, and then James's best friend Lank and his wife Ray, who's Elizabeth's best friends. The four of them had problems now in areas where they didn't even used to have areas. They both wore glasses. James had had two skin cancers removed from his widening bald spot. Elizabeth had a hammer toe and ensuing gigantic corns, which always grew back after removal. James's best friend Lank had a bad rotator cuff. Ray, his wife, and Elizabeth's best friend, was getting carpal tunnel syndrome from the years at her loom and wore a wrist brace. Both women leaked if they laughed or coughed too hard, and everybody's back ached except Rosie's. Lank had such terrible night vision now that no one would even drive with him at night, although he wore glasses, which magnified his already big brown eyes to the size of a rainforest mammal's. Lank taught high school in Petaluma, just north of where they lived, and he had responded to Elizabeth's periodic misery by inventing a church just for her when she was having a hard time with 17-year-old Rosie. It was called Seeing the Light Ministries. Not long ago, during an awful patch between Elizabeth and Rosie, Lank had, in his capacity as pastor, reminded Elizabeth of the doctrine against raising your kids as if they were precious equals. This seemed to be the current national parenting trend, but it was utterly misguided. You, Elizabeth, are the sun, he told her over the phone. The child is merely a moon. She has no light of her own, no income, no car. She's a satellite. Her judgment is frequently poor, and she is mean. She's South Africa before the revolution, cruel and crazy. Divest, Elizabeth, divest. So then they all said, Elizabeth is a sober alcoholic, but she's really been having a hard time staying sober. She's had a slip fairly recently. And James is a really wonderful husband to her, I think, but he is the one who draws more boundaries around Rosie. And he is sitting there. They're sitting in the parkade. It's not like they're going to take Rosie off to have oral surgery, you know. They want to take her shopping, and still she's late because she's a teenager. She's just an imperfect person. And I say without judgment. So finally, Elizabeth, you know, part of the novel is about how does a marriage stay strong and full of love when there's a huge secret going on in the family, which is the kid is at a lot more risk than anyone has had any reason to know yet. So finally Elizabeth gets up with James and pulls him to his feet, and they're just going to go home now. They've reached critical mass with Rosie. So they're headed toward the car, but just then Elizabeth heard from across the street, Mama, Mama, James. There she was, smiling, waving, walking toward them. tall and broad-shouldered after a childhood of being so thin, her black hair piled on her head the way Ray wore hers, too, like hippie girl, secured with pencils, silver clasps, porcelain chopsticks. Her breasts were nearly as big as Elizabeth's now. Everyone, men and women alike, checked them out. Even children checked them out with memory and fear and desperation. She wore short, shredded cutoffs and a white gypsy shirt over the spandex top that tried to contain the sprawl. So, let's see, Elizabeth is trying to pretend to be slightly cool about Rosie having finally shown up, but it's hard. She just loves her so much. She says that she walks into her arms like happy as a devotee or a golden retriever. Rosie peered at James as if looking around a corner. He scrutinized his watch, tapped the watch face. "I'm sorry, James," she said. "I swear I'll make it up to you." "I hate waiting," Rosie said. "I hate waiting." "Well, then, next time," she said, "just leave." Elizabeth jumps in. Elizabeth is always jumping in, trying to smooth things over and keep there from being waves. "Honey, why aren't you wearing sunglasses?" she asked. Rosie shrugged. "Honey, it's important. It's your only real protection from more sun damage." "Oh, God, was that concealer under Rosie's eyes? Did you get a good sleep?" she continued, worried, studying the faint blue crescent she now saw under Rosie's eyes. "I didn't hear you come in last night, Rosie. Hey, have you eaten? Did you at least eat some fruit before you came? Let's get you a muffin before we go shopping." "God, Mom," Rosie said, "stop. I'm not a child." James started to say something, but Rosie made a face of exasperation and reached forward with a burlesque flourish to choke him, and in spite of himself, he smiled. He ambushed her with a wrestling move. She easily slid out of his grasp. Each of them knew all the other's moves. James leered at her, and she countered with a karate chop to his neck. He took 3 steps back and went into the one yoga pose he knew, downward-facing dog. Elizabeth and Rosie exchanged a look. He was such an idiot. When he got up, the three of them set off together down the street. So there's the whole novel. It's the paragraph before when it says that each of them knew all the other's moves. Well, you know what? If they do, you don't have a novel, right? With a 17-year-old, you never know the next move. And so there they are, the family a few years later.
Wow.
Strong. Screwed up like all families, and the setting off together down the street. So that's really Imperfect Birds.
That's Anne Lamott with Imperfect Birds. Having gone through, you know, raising 2 children to adulthood and being way on the other side now, this puts me back into recalling a time and feeling that I really would not want to go through again. I got that middle of the night phone call from the police.
Oh, you did.
I did.
To me, it's just so incredibly exciting that it's behind me.
Yeah, and you have a grandchild now.
Oh my God! But the thing is,
payoff.
Yeah.
It's wonderful, I think, not to be alone. And if you either have a partner or like a couple of friends who have kids your age, who will say the great spiritual connective tissue words of, you know what, me too, I know what it's like, no, my kid isn't perfect, you know what, we're scared a lot, you know what, we don't know what we're doing either, you know what, let's keep talking together. As soon as you have someone you can be absolutely honest with, you're really home free, but as a parent of a teenager. But the scary part is not wanting to talk to anyone about it because you're so used to smoothing everything over and working on the appearance and burnishing the surface of stuff. So, and Rosie's an exquisite student. She's taking AP courses, so she's got a higher than 4.0 average. She's a competitive tennis player. She's gorgeous. She's a fantastic kid, and yet she's got the secret teenage life going on. And no parent can do it alone.
And everybody thinks everybody else's kids are perfect. Or, you know, people
there's
put
that famous
on a
line
show.
Of that we keep comparing our insides to other people's outsides.
Mm.
So you see that other families, when you run into them at the market or at the school, or you see their kids succeeding on stage, you think that means who they are.
Or you read their Christmas letter.
Finally, when you start talking to them, you might understand that their kid actually is in therapy, or their kid has had a terrible problem with buying Ritalin, you know, unprescribed Ritalin, or their kid has an eating disorder or whatever. It's just that if you compare your insides, which are scared and anxious and full of self-doubt and catastrophizing, to other people's surfaces, it makes you feel more alone than you can have ever, ever, ever imagined.
Would you like to explain the origin of the title to our listeners?
Well, it comes from a line of Rumi's, which is that each of us must make a nest, each of us must find our way into the nest of the other imperfect birds. Mm. And it's so, two things struck me, that one, that the path of salvation really means that you find your way into somebody else's sort of cluttered makeshift nest, you know, made with the bits of ribbon and string and hair that the bird found that day, and that is really where hope lies, is being able to be welcomed in whatever shape you're in, and the offering, what we have to offer in my work as my mother in any way, is I can welcome people into my nest, and I can say, oh, I found this string down at the Chicago waterfront. Oh, I got this little funny piece of ribbon actually at the airport in Boston, and I just saw it lying there, and I thought it was pretty, and I could show you around my nest, and that is salvation. And the other thing was, it's so shocking to think of the phrase that there could ever be an imperfect bird. Like, even if it was wounded, it's still so precious and beautiful. Hmm. And yet, when we think of ourselves, and especially teenagers, it's only a collage of imperfection. So I thought it was kind of bracing to think why we do have this critical mind that sees us in such grave imperfection, always with products we could buy that would help us with this. And the truth is, you would never think that about a bird.
That's so true. That's so true. We've been speaking today with Anne Lamotte, who will be appearing in Des Moines at the Hoyt Sherman Place Theater. I think that's sponsored by the Des Moines Public Library, Wednesday, April 13th at 7 p.m. And what do you have planned for that event? Will you be reading from Imperfect Birds and speaking, taking questions, all of the above?
Theoretically, I'm reading and talking about Imperfect Birds, but to tell you the truth, I can't commit to that right now, because I've also just been showing up and taking votes and saying, how many people want to have a reading and a talk about Imperfect Birds? There's often one person, and then there'll be 200 people that would really rather talk about writing and real life and faith and the administration and stuff. So, but I'll certainly be talking a little bit about, or maybe entirely about, Imperfect Birds. All I can say is I don't know now.
And I want to tell you, you mentioned faith. I want to tell you that you really gave me hope with your books on faith, because I was feeling so much like Christianity had gone down this dark path and
It has, and
turned away from the true message of, you know, Jesus's radical message of social justice. And it brought me hope to know that there are people out there who do call themselves Christians who still
are also radical left wing activists.
Exactly. I'm just so thrilled that not only are you doing it, but you are writing about it. And I hope you write more about that.
Thank you so much. Thank you for making the time for me today, too.
Well, thank you for making the time for us. And we have like 1 minute left. Do you have some final words of advice for writers out there in the audience?
You know, I hate to sound like the Nike commercial, but you ultimately just do it. You know, you don't have a cute bumper sticker thing. You sit down, you do it. You sit down at the same time every day. You do it as a debt of honor. I'm choking. You do it by prearrangement with yourself. Mm. You don't hope that you can get some work done today. You just get your work done. You want to be a writer. You just get your work done. That's what it's about.
Mm. Cheryl, do you have...
I have to go to the... No, because I'm choking.
Okay, well, thank you so
much
really
for being with us.
We really appreciated you visiting.
Bye. Thank you so much for your time.
It was our pleasure. Goodbye.
Okay. Bye.
So if you're just tuning in, that was Anne Lamott. And if you didn't hear the whole interview, we'll be rebroadcasting Friday at 1 p.m. Central here on KRUU 100.1 FM. You can also access it on live stream at kruufm.com. And you can go see and hear and talk to Anne Wednesday in Des Moines. And do you have any final words, Cheryl?
Yeah, I think that it was a really interesting, fun hour with Anne Lamott.
So stay tuned for whatever's coming up next on KRUU. If you're listening on Friday, it will be Planet Earthwild with James Moore. And see you next week.
Writer's Voices is hosted, produced, and engineered by Monica Hadley, Caroline Kilborn, Cheryl Fusco-Johnson, and Corey Hickenbottom. Archives are available at kruufm.com and writersvoices.com. Writer's Voices is a production of KRUULP 100.1 FM, broadcasting from the Cultural District in Fairfield, Iowa.